Brains are complex systems of connections, modulated by connections, modulated by connections.
So would you try to mess with those complex connections with a dose of electricity at home? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter
out. In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
On today's show, people coming back to life after having been dead, bones going back home in gigantic crates, and speech not quite coming back after stroke. But first up, your Fitbit is old news. The next wave in wearable technology goes beyond tracking what we do and moves more actively into self-improvement territory. Battery-powered headbands that stimulate your brain. So-called neuromodulation devices rely on a small current of electricity to tweak a user's cognition and mood. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports on an industry poised to jolt into the mainstream.
Nobody knows what the Halo neuroscience machine will look like. The company, to date, is only speaking in broad terms.
We want to build a product that's a wearable, that's ridiculously simple and easy to use.
This is Daniel Chow, founder and CEO of the San Francisco-based startup.
We also want it to be aesthetically pleasing and not scary to look at or to wear.
With the catchphrase, "Be electric," Halo plans to launch its device in 2015. It relies on something called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. If you're picturing shock therapy, dial those expectations way back. Roy Hamilton is a neurology professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
The current we apply is very small, 1 to 2 milliamperes. Think of it as being on the same order as the current you get out of a 9-volt battery.
Hamilton researches how TDCS can be used to restore function in people who have suffered strokes and other brain injuries. It works by placing two electrodes, one positive, the other negative, onto various parts of the scalp.
And what happens is that this current passing through the brain, it's not enough current, it's insufficient to actually cause brain cells to fire at that time. But it is powerful enough to make very, very small changes in the likelihood that neurons are going to fire over a given period of time.
The theory is, if you take that small change and multiply it by the billions of neurons in the brain, that adds up to an effect that can be measured. Studies have shown mixed results, but TDCS has helped some people with conditions including depression, anxiety, and chronic pain. In otherwise healthy brains, there's also interest in its potential to improve memory, learning, math skills, even visual sharpness. Put on the thinking cap for a 20-minute session, and some people say the world becomes clearer. The long-term effects, though, are still somewhat muddy.
It is oversimplified to think about cognition in the brain as some simple switch that you can turn on or off or turn up or down by adding electricity to the brain. Right? Brains are complex systems of connections, modulated by connections, modulated by connections. And so it isn't necessarily the case that if you enhance one type of performance, that you're not inadvertently manipulating some other type of performance that you don't know about in some way that you don't want.
Proving that these devices are safe is going to be critical to their commercial success. Along with Halo, a venture capital-backed company called Think is also releasing an at-home TDCS unit next year. Going with the catchphrase, shift/conquer, early reports suggest the product is going to target mood enhancement. There may be a setting to stimulate, another to wind down. The company brought on City College of New York professor Merome Bixon to do its clinical trial.
The short of it is that we found that both regular TDCS and the Think device
were very well tolerated. There were no serious adverse events. That means nothing bad happened that anybody had to get, you know, go to the hospital or get medical treatment for.
Bixson says the device could help meet a growing demand for low-cost TDCS. There are some companies already selling units. The ventures are small scale, and the products are far from polished. One customer described his purchase as looking like a homemade bomb detonator. Other early adapters are saving themselves a few hundred dollars by making their own stimulators.
So I have the machine perfected, well, almost perfected. I mean, it's a lot better than it was last time.
YouTube catalogs a range of at-home solutions. With $50 in Radio Shack, you can build one using instructions easily found online. While it would be nearly impossible for the FDA to regulate that sort of activity, it isn't clear yet if it is going to oversee the commercial ventures. A spokesperson says the agency doesn't comment on products that may be under review. But beyond potential regulation, the idea of cognitive enhancement brings up larger ethical questions for Hank Greeley. He's director of Stanford's program in neuroscience and society and says, imagine a world where this technology has been perfected and TDCS can be harnessed to produce really sizable gains. Then what? Do only the relatively wealthy get access? Could some people be forced to use it?
Forced by their employer, forced by the military, forced by their parents, forced by their debate coach, whatever it is. And I think those coercion issues are a big deal.
Greeley knows we are a long way off from having to tackle those issues. This is still a relatively young area of science and industry, but it's one where Daniel Chow of Halo sees huge potential, if not immediate universal acceptance.
Early on, we will have people that really embrace this technology and want to use it. But to have the masses really jump on board, I think it'll take quite some time.
However, with its intrinsic promise of a better version of you, TDCS's move from fringe to mainstream isn't so hard to imagine. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Brain stimulation, perhaps not done at home, but rather in a medical setting, often becomes a last resort kind of option for people with depression when nothing else has helped. Antidepressants work for only about half the people taking them. Half. Lynn Bates of Senatoga, Pennsylvania, is part of the unlucky 50%. She suffered with depression for 4 decades.
I can't even remember being in places because I always had a cloud over my head.
Sometimes one medicine would help a little bit.
And I wouldn't go any further than that. It would be just like a flat line.
Bates is trying a new approach to deal with her relentless depression. It's an off-label use of an anesthesia drug. She's driven over 2 hours to Princeton, New Jersey, and is about to get an injection of ketamine. It's her fifth in a series of 6 treatments over the course of 2 weeks.
And you mentioned before a little bit of nerves heading into that, right, from this time when you've had this frequent treatment.
Her psychiatrist, Stephen Levine, is a tall, energetic guy in his 30s. He explains what's going to happen next.
Angela, who's the nurse, will come in just a moment. She'll start an intravenous line.
Levine got interested in ketamine because he felt frustrated with the lack of options available to people who weren't responding to antidepressants.
These folks never get included in studies. They don't make good study participants because people expect them not to respond. Even in studies of treatment-resistant depression, you'll be excluded if you've failed to respond, as the lingo goes, to 2 or 3 previous trials.
Enter ketamine. As an anesthesia drug, it seems like an unlikely candidate in treating depression, and it has a nefarious second life. It's known as the hallucinogenic street drug Special K. But its impact on persistent depression is impressive, says Stephen Levine.
So here's this population that never gets studied, that everybody would expect would not respond to something, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly. So that caught my attention.
Why ketamine works is not yet understood, but in several studies, over half of patients experience significant improvement of their symptoms. After delving into the available research, Levine decided to open the Ketamine Treatment Centers of Princeton, the only outpatient clinic offering the service in New Jersey and one of only about 20 in the country. He has seen several hundred patients over the past 3 years.
Today was good. I feel like it tied up some loose ends. And
after her infusion, Lynn Bates looks a little tired. She describes the treatment as a dreamlike state where she journeys into her head and can walk through her feelings and emotions. And she's feeling good.
Oh my gosh, this is how life is supposed to feel like. That's how I feel. It's been a long road. It really has.
So this sounds like a very hopeful story so far, right? But some researchers feel like the use of ketamine is growing too quickly.
What these clinics are doing is essentially experimentation on individual patients.
Dominic Sisti is a medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. He sees a lot of potential in ketamine as a treatment for depression, but cautions that doctors simply don't know enough yet about the long-term impact and potential health risks.
If, for example, an unfortunate adverse event were to happen and a patient would be harmed, that would set back the larger research enterprise that's legitimately happening at research centers, at academic centers across the country.
Stephen Levine pushes back on that point and argues that having this option is far better than having none at all.
Now we're comparing the risk of using this treatment versus having no other options. And so with severe depression, somebody feeling that their back is against the wall and they have no options, I'm not sure there's anything much more dangerous than that.
There's also a cost issue. Ketamine is not typically covered by insurance, and an infusion costs several hundred dollars. Sisti says some ketamine clinics offer questionable financial deals to persuade patients to try the drug.
You see an offer that says, get your 5 ketamine infusions and your 6th for free. That sort of slants the incentive structure in such a way that individuals who are suffering with depression, who might be feeling vulnerable and desperate, and maybe have concerns about continuing ketamine treatment, will feel pressure to continue.
Levine doesn't offer such financial deals at his clinic and says he's able to bill for the visit in a way that is covered by most of his patients' insurance companies.
I'll see you in a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
For Lynn Bates, the initial round of 6 infusions is over, and she said she noticed her mood dipping after about 3 weeks. So now she's on a schedule of maintenance infusions that will happen about once a month. The effects of ketamine are not long-lasting, and Stephen Levine says one of the challenges is trying to optimize the treatment schedule for each patient so that they receive just the right amount to keep their depression at bay. Coming up on The Pulse, what does being dead really mean? A physician reflects on the practice of resuscitation.
It seemed to me to be very aggressive, very invasive. Led me to think about whether this is something we should be doing as often as we do. But in the moment, we're just trying to get the next shock administered.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The flu shot has a bit of a PR problem every year, right? Because people think they don't really need it. It may actually be giving you the flu, or it doesn't do anything anyway. And now last week came an announcement from the Centers for Disease Control that this year's flu shot may offer less protection than expected. So what happened there? Tanya English explains.
Scientists have one chance each year to predict which influenza strains are most likely to make us sick. and those estimates have to happen months and months in advance.
So to give you perspective, in 2 months, we're going to be choosing what's going to go into next year's flu vaccine.
That's Scott Hensley. He's a vaccine researcher at Philadelphia's Wistar Institute. He studies how the flu virus mutates. That's what happened this season.
So by the time that we realize the mutation has had crept up, it's at this point it's just too late to go back and remake the vaccine.
The protection packed into this year's vaccine is designed to fight three subtypes of flu. But one strain has changed. It's morphed a little in recent months. Hensley says the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control usually do a pretty good job. But in the past 2 decades, there have been 3 or 4 years where there was a mismatch.
And most of the time, they get it right.
Do we know how often they get it wrong?
Well, I would argue that if you only have 60% efficacy, it's never right completely.
How well the flu vaccine works varies from year to year. That reality and this season's big mismatch make for a complicated public health conversation.
So I imagine that some people may be more reluctant to get the flu shot because of this news, and that's really not the right message.
Because even a less effective vaccine is the best tool we've got to fight influenza.
You can tell when flu may be the culprit.
Kristen Feemster is an infectious disease physician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She says flu can cause achiness, cough, and fever that can send someone to the emergency room.
You know, physicians will say they can see it in a child's face. They look very tired. There's just maybe a little bit of a lack of light in their eyes, and they look tired.
It's too early to know if the flu subtype that's making most people sick right now will continue to be the big problem in coming weeks.
We don't know whether or not this H3N2 strain is going to be the dominant strain for the entire season.
Engineering a good flu vaccine is a guessing game. Still, flu researcher Scott Hensley says it's a sophisticated, well-funded, science-based guessing game.
It's not all or nothing, right? That if you get vaccinated, yeah, you might get sick this year, even if you're vaccinated.
Partial protection may be enough to keep flu from becoming serious.
Makes you sick for a couple days rather than have a really long hospital stay.
Hensley says the next step is to move beyond annual flu predictions and build a better universal flu vaccine that targets the parts of the virus that never change. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
It's The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Imagine there was a form of amnesia that caused everybody to forget about you and who you are. Or what if you had a wound that got worse with each dark thought or bad deed you commit? Or you woke up in the morning and suddenly you had your neighbor's ailment and he had yours. These are some of the maladies described in a new book called The Afflictions, a fictional encyclopedia of imaginary diseases written by a physician. Peter Crimmins reports on what fiction can tell us about medicine.
Not too long ago, I broke my hand. Kind of bad. I had to have surgery. The doctor put a metal plate and 7 screws into a metal carpal bone of my left hand, and I'm left-handed. The way I broke my hand is actually not very interesting. It got caught between my dog and a park bench, and then bam, titanium plate, 3 months of physical therapy. So my hand was not broken because of negligence or aggression or hubris or injustice. It was nobody's fault. It just happened.
I think it's intrinsic to human nature that we try to find a mechanism or a reason behind everything that happens in the world. If a meteor falls from the sky, who sent that meteor and why did that happen?
That is Vikram Paralkar. He's an oncologist at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in cancers of the blood.
Especially in the case of cancer, many people ask, why did this happen to me? The answer really is that when cells divide, DNA makes mistakes. That answer is immensely unsatisfying. It's just the way we are programmed. We try to see patterns and reasons in the world around us.
Paralkar has just published his first book. It's a work of fiction called The Afflictions. It explores the mystery of disease and how we react to it. It's an encyclopedia of imaginary diseases, each entry complete with invented cures and fictional case studies. This volume supposedly sits in a library in 16th century Portugal.
An older librarian named Senhor José is leading a young apprentice named Maximo through this library. And in the course of a day, they skim through pages of the Encyclopedia Medicinae, or the Medical Encyclopedia, which is a compendium of all medical knowledge that is available in this fictional world.
If you couldn't tell, Paralkar is heavily influenced by Jorge Luis Borges and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the masters of magical realism. And some of the details of this invented world are pretty wild. Take the disease called Renascentia. It hits one village every year on a particular day. And on that day, the inhabitants of the village swap ailments. Literally, you start the day with, say, cancer, but end it with no cancer. Instead, you have the epilepsy your neighbor used to have.
Some leave with freshly pockmarked faces, others with new obstructions of their bowels. Some receive dementias or epilepsies or fulminant afflictions, and others are cured of consumption. Their amputated limbs grow back, or their pustules vanish. They weep with relief.
One of the ideas that this disease tries to explore is the arbitrariness by which diseases are given out to people in the world. If this were to happen on a single day every year, you were to get a completely new set of diseases, you would consider it to be an awfully arbitrary and unjust system. But yet, is it any more unjust than what exists now, which is that people just are allotted their own random set of diseases that follow them for the rest of their lives, sometimes even truncate their lives?
I want to bring up a different disease, Agricola's disease. The way you describe this, this is a disease of hearing. It's a disease that makes you go deaf. The twist is that there is a very extremely rare elixir that will temporarily restore your hearing for a very brief time, and very, I guess, an intense time. And then it fades. And then the invalid goes nuts, goes mad, because he wants that elixir, and it's way too expensive to keep on hand. And so what's interesting about this is you're describing, in part, the disease, but also how people react to the disease.
Well, one of the things you realize with modern medicine, especially with the treatment of cancer, is that we have drugs that may give incremental benefits, but which have enormous price tags associated with them. One of the thoughts, at least in this book, is, people who are deaf would be able to adapt to their deafness and live perfectly productive lives. But people with this particular disease, because there exists an elixir out there that can give them temporary relief, they end up entirely devoting their lives to trying to get this elixir. And in that sense, the remedy destroys their lives much more than the malady itself could have done.
The common thread connecting Paralkar's 50 fictional diseases is a kind of single-field theory of illness. These ailments have to do with the fracturing of the self, or the parts breaking from the whole. In fact, one of Paralkar's invented ailments is called persona fracta, or fractured person. There's a case study of a seamstress who believes every one of her bodily functions is controlled by a different person. So the walking seamstress is different from the breathing seamstress, is different from the talking seamstress. She has infinite personas.
The disease actually doesn't harm the seamstress. She thinks of her body as made up of an infinite number of characters, but they all seem to work together just fine. It's considered as a disease because it doesn't fit into the norm of what you might think of. Some of these are not really diseases, but they're labeled as diseases by that particular medical community.
For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Peter's story included the voice of Juliana Zinkel, who will play the lead in Under the Skin, a medical play premiering at the Arden Theatre in January. You're listening to The Pulse.
The change would be very subtle. It might take 10 years or so. Gradually his face would change its shape.
At one time, David Casseret thought he wanted to be an ER doctor, but once in medical school, he quickly realized that world wasn't for him at all. Instead, he became a palliative care physician. He helps patients who are very ill or at the end of life. So he spent a lot of time thinking about the transition between life and death and has written a new book on techniques that seemingly create a path from one to the other. In Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, Casseret describes the evolution of modern resuscitation techniques, and it's nothing like we've all seen on Baywatch.
I have no pulse.
Compressions, Caroline, ventilations.
One and two and three and four and five.
Still no pulse.
Keep going. First and analyze. Clear.
Clear.
Clear. Clear. She's shockable. Shocking.
I have a pulse. She's breathing.
What
happens on TV is very clean and very pristine and very, very effective. And CPR in real life is none of those things. CPR in real life involves pushing on somebody's chest, often pushing hard enough to break ribs, breathing either through a tube or sometimes using mouth to mouth, and then repeated shocks to the chest that the patient doesn't feel because he or she is unconscious. But it's very aggressive. People who have seen CPR for the first time often describe it as looking almost violent.
How many patients are resuscitated in this fashion in a given year?
It depends on where you are and what you're talking about, but easily a couple hundred thousand probably in the United States alone.
And what is roughly the success rate?
Well, it depends. If you're watching television, if you're watching Baywatch, the success rate is
100%.
Or probably 60 or 70%. It's unfortunately not nearly that good in real life. The other thing we see on television is that when people revive, they revive immediately and they go back to doing whatever it is they're doing. And in reality, it's not nearly that clean or effective. It depends on where you are. Cardiac arrest in a nursing home, in an older person with many health problems, those patients might only have a 1 or 2% chance of returning to where they were before the cardiac arrest. In other situations, particularly if there's an automatic external defibrillator handy, sort of a shock in a box that's present in train stations or shopping malls, your chances of being resuscitated might be as high as 1 in 3, but still a long way from the two-thirds that television tells us about.
You describe in the book the history of how we learned about resuscitation. So what were some of the early efforts and how did they get refined?
It's safe to say that back in the 1800s, people tried pretty much everything you can think of, from tickling people with feathers to beating them with whips to putting their feet in boiling water to one of my own personal favorites, which is to take a drowning victim and throw him over the back of a trotting horse. In shock, I actually tried that to see what it would feel like. I described that in gruesome detail. Suffice it to say, it's not something that your listeners would want to try at home.
And then when did we become serious about it? When did we really make advances?
Well, it's interesting. We actually started to make advances way back in the 1800s, although we didn't necessarily realize it then. One of the oddest techniques of resuscitation back then was something called, somewhat ominously, the Russian method, which involved burying people in snow or ice. And that's an interesting technique because if you cool people, it makes it harder to start their hearts again. On the other hand, the colder you are, the slower your metabolism is. And the slower your metabolism is, the longer you can survive in periods of not having enough oxygen without significant brain damage. So cold is something that many CPR studies are starting to use today to try to chill people, often to very, very cold temperatures, to try to protect brains and other organs.
But the issue, I guess, you raise in your book is that saving the life is great right there in that moment, but then there's often some kind of fallout on the other side. So describe that big question a bit.
It's an interesting question that many of my patients have had to deal with. I'm a hospice doctor. I take care of patients near the end of life. And many of my patients have had to make these sorts of decisions. Many people have decided they want aggressive treatment. They wanted to be resuscitated. And many of them have been brought back to life, but brought back to life in a condition that they really didn't want to be in. In shock, I use the example of the mythologic story of Tithonus, who mythology tells us asked Zeus for immortality, but forgot to ask for eternal youth. And so he stayed alive. He couldn't die, but he continued to get older and sicker and more frail. And to some degree, that's what we're able to do for a lot of the patients that I take care of. We're able to fix simple problems. We're able to restart a heart often, but we can't cure the underlying vascular disease or heart disease or dementia that caused them to get in that situation in the first place.
David, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, gosh, it was a pleasure.
David Casaret has written Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Coming up on The Pulse, when things suddenly no longer make sense.
I kept dropping everything. I would look for it and I couldn't find it. I couldn't scan the ground. I couldn't see my hand.
Life-changing moments and a long journey back. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. You and I, we're currently communicating. It's what we do all day long. So imagine if that ability is suddenly no longer functioning right. In our series Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and recovery, we hear from Melissa Mead. She's getting her PhD in communication from Temple University. But that goal was almost derailed 7 years ago when she suffered a series of three strokes over the course of a day and a half. Alana Gordon brings us her story.
So many things had gone awry. I couldn't speak. I sideswiped my car. But the thing that kind of convinced me to go to the hospital was the celery. I went to the grocery store, I bought some groceries, and I was putting them away, and I was feeling so out of my body. And I was putting away the groceries, and my hand, my right hand, I don't know the way it felt when it touched this cold celery. But if the celery didn't feel like it was very cold. It felt like it should have been colder. And I thought, okay, I'm just really having a neurological thing.
When do you think it started?
You know, I was instructing college-level Spanish. It was towards the end of the class. I was looking at this book and I saw that those things that were supposed to be words become not words. I know that they're supposed to be letters, but they look like insect legs, like specks of dirt or flies' legs. So I was like, maybe it's Spanish and I'll just look at something English. And that wasn't readable either. I start to feel the sense of urgency. The sense of urgency comes over you. Students were looking at me, and they were looking for speech. I had lost all ability to communicate. I couldn't do a thing. I had three massive strokes as a result of a left internal carotid artery dissection in December of 2007. That was 7 years ago, right? 7 years ago. I was 32. I was 32 when it happened.
Were you healthy?
I was healthy, yeah. There's a lot of different ways that someone could have a stroke. I had an ischemic stroke, which is apparently a way that sometimes young people have strokes. Your brain is being denied blood or oxygen. So my brain tissue is dying. I had diagnosis of speech aphasia. I went to the pharmacy for the first time to pay for my medicine after I had the strokes. And I went to pay, and I was going to pay in cash. And when I got it out of my wallet, I was like, what the hell is this? And I didn't know what money was. I didn't recognize money any longer.
Mm-hmm.
such a mysterious organ, the brain. How when you get an insult to it, a stroke, that injures the part of the brain that affects language, that it can do really peculiar things.
Caterpillars may eat plants that contain certain toxins. The caterpillar has the ability to store the toxin into the adult butterfly's head.
So what is this simulating?
Comprehension impairment.
The adult butterfly sees badly to potential predators because of these toxins. The bright red, orange, and black colors on some butterflies are warnings to observers that they are sishan.
This is showing you that some words are altered or made inaudible, or rather incomprehensible.
And that would happen for you?
That happens for me all the time.
Has that happened in our conversation?
Sometimes.
Like in the conversation we're having?
A little bit. Sometimes I will mix up numbers that aren't even next to each other.
20.
If it's on an answering machine, I repeat it sometimes. 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times. 1, 9, 8, 7, 2, 0, 4, 6, 7, 2, 0, 8, 10 times. Not the same since I had a stroke. Just like things aren't as clear. In some ways it's interesting, in other ways it's very frustrating.
What are your coping strategies?
I get people to repeat. I'm very meticulous, like overly careful. It makes me think about the way that people work through disability.
Melissa Mead is getting her PhD in communication at Temple University with a focus on language and social interaction. She's a recipient of several honors, including one from the Philadelphia Mayor's Office for her successes on how she's incorporated disability into her classroom teachings. Alana Gordon produced this story. Melissa's story brought up a lot of questions about speech aphasia and how our brains bounce back from strokes. And joining us now is Myrna Schwartz. She is a neuroscientist who runs a language aphasia research lab at the Moss Rehabilitation Institute in Philadelphia. Myrna, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
What exactly happens to the brain that causes these kinds of comprehension problems?
Well, aphasia is a disorder that affects language in all of its manifestations. And that means that speaking can be affected and often is. Understanding language can be affected, reading, writing. And language is organized, produced in usually the left side of the brain. And in a form that's almost like a mosaic, which is to say that different language skills are represented in particular areas. And so depending on where the stroke hits, depending on which particular tissues die, which are temporarily in shock and can subsequently recover, depending on all of those things, one can see a very different pattern of language impairment. In Melissa's case, from what she described, the stroke affected had lasting consequences, primarily in her ability to comprehend language. Her speaking is much less affected, which is rare. And it sounds like numbers may be particularly difficult for her. That's part of the extraordinary mosaic pattern that we see in the brain, is that different categories of words and concepts can be selectively affected.
We hear so much about brain plasticity these days.
Yes.
And the brain's ability to change, to adapt, to do all those things. So
What are the outcomes typically for people who are dealing with this?
It's such a mysterious area. This is the reason why so much scientific research is going into this area now. First of all, because in contrast to the way things were when I entered the field 30-some-odd years ago, we now recognize that the brain has, the adult brain, has much greater plasticity than we ever thought was possible. So now a great deal of research is looking at the question of how can we harness the brain's plasticity in order to maximize recovery from stroke. And that involves several steps. One step is to have a really refined diagnosis of what the language problem is so that we can target behavioral therapies, the kinds of practice skills that are done in speech-language therapy. Another thing is to understand exactly how the brain computes those specialized processes and what the capacity is of the residual tissue. So we're studying how the tissue around a stroke sometimes recovers the function and how the tissue in the opposite hemisphere, on the opposite side of the brain, can sometimes contribute to the recovery.
What are the biggest frustrations of people who are dealing with aphasia? It's often when our language goes or is impacted, it seems like we can't be who we are or people's perceptions of us change.
Oh, by all means, that is so true. One tremendous universal frustration, people with aphasia, families living with aphasia, and those of us who work on this area, is that it's so poorly understood. So, for example, we estimate that 1 million Americans live with aphasia, which is approximately the same number as live with Parkinson's disease, and yet so much more is known about Parkinson's disease than is known about aphasia. So one frustration is that when people encounter a person with aphasia, they don't know what they're encountering. And because language is really the mirror on our thinking and our intelligence, if you will, there's very often a misunderstanding that a person with a language problem has some sort of general cognitive impairment.
When you talk to patients, what do you tell them in terms of the outlook to have or how to cope with that and perhaps also their families?
So we know that plasticity is greatest in the months following a stroke. And so it's very important that people have speech-language therapy for aphasia in those months following the stroke. But what we now realize is that recovery can go on for very long durations after that, long periods of time after that. And that recovery from aphasia is very much like learning a second language, if you will, right? I mean, if you stop doing it, you lose it, right? In order to keep it active and keep the learning happening and keep improving, you have to keep working at it. And that's the main thing we tell families. The most important thing is to get back into life as much as possible. We speak all the time. We practice talking and listening, and communication is something that we engage in all the time. The worst thing that can happen and does happen after a stroke is isolation, self-imposed isolation because of embarrassment. That's the biggest thing that we have to combat.
Myrna, thank you so much for being here.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Myrna Schwartz is a neuroscientist who runs a language aphasia research lab at the Moss Rehabilitation Institute. You're listening to The Pulse, and our show just celebrated its first birthday. So we threw a party and we did a live version of the program. And if you couldn't be with us that night, we wanted to share one of the highlights from the event. It's an interview with Ken Lecovera, a paleontologist at Drexel University, who found a huge dinosaur, the Dreadnoughtus. Let's take a listen. Tell me about this site where you found the Dreadnoughtus.
So we found Dreadnoughtus in southernmost Argentina, down near Tierra del Fuego. It's a very remote location, about 100 miles off of the power grid. I've spent about a year in my tent next to the Dreadnoughtus quarry so far. And the animal that we dug up was represented by 145 bones. And most of the really big giant dinosaurs are known from just a couple of bones, in some cases one, two, three bones. So this gives us a really good window into the anatomy and therefore the biology of the biggest creatures to ever walk the planet.
And how did you know that he was there? Or did you have an inkling? How do you guys do that?
Well, we all kind of use the same formula. You find rocks of the right age, and that's pretty easy today that the world is geologically mapped. They have to be sedimentary rocks. And then today it's helpful if it's a desert environment. So you get good exposure of the rocks and good rates of erosion. And then the fourth thing I like to have is to get as far away from other paleontologists as possible. Right. And if you have the first three things, you will find fossils. And if you have the fourth thing, you'll probably find something new.
And did you know right away that this was a huge find? Did you find one and then another and then another? How was that?
I did know right away. So the first bone that I found was a femur, the thigh bone, that was almost 7 feet long. Yeah, it was really big. And so right away I knew that there was not another dinosaur that lived in geological time within about 30 million years of it that was that size. And I knew I was very far from any other location. So I knew immediately that it was a new species. I was hoping there'd be more than one bone. By the end of the day, we had 10 bones exposed. And then 5 years later, we had that 145.
So tell me about the kind of moments after your discovery. What is that like?
Well, I think this is why we're all in it. You know, it's that moment of discovery, and it's that one moment when you realize that you're seeing something that no other human being has ever seen, and that you know something for a moment that nobody's ever known before. And that keeps all of us going, and that's why we suffer the deprivations that we do in the field when you're always tired or hot or cold or bruised or bleeding sometimes. But when you make discoveries like that, it's worth it.
So yeah. Tell me about all the times when you didn't find the Dreadnoughtus. All the times it must be, as you said, exhausting. You're hot, you're cold, you're tired, frustrating.
No. I love the field work. I love being out there. I've never come home empty-handed, actually, so I've been lucky in that regard. If you don't find a bone, you're bound to find a rock. And the rocks tell a story, you know, and when you're trained in geology, it's like reading the pages of the most amazing book that there is. And so it's always satisfying being out in the field.
So tell us about the Dreadnoughtus. What kind of a guy was he?
So Dreadnoughtus is a long neck, long tail plant eater. Think Apatosaurus or Brontosaurus for shorthand. In life, it would have been about 85 feet long. It would be about 2.5 stories at the shoulder. And fleshed out, it would weigh 65 tons. 65 tons is the mass of 9 T-Rex,
yeah,
or 13 bull African elephants. It's about 10 tons heavier than a Boeing 737.
But this was an herbivore.
You can only get this big if you eat plants, right?
All, Why?
All
really?
The energy in the ecosystem comes from photosynthesis to begin
with. I thought
we
ate plants to stay small.
Well.
As women, anyway. I've been wronged.
It didn't work for Dreadnoughtus. Right. Yeah.
So the bones now are going back to where they came from, right? So will you keep 3D prints off them around here?
Yeah, that's right. So I had to change out of my work clothes before I came here because I'm literally building crates in my lab right now. And Dreadnoughtus goes back in about 2 weeks to Argentina.
And will you miss him when he's gone?
I think I'm going to shed a few tears when Dreadnoughtus leaves, yeah.
Ken LaCarrera, thank you so much for joining us.
So as Drexel paleontologist Ken LaCarrera just mentioned, he's packing up the dino bones to ship them back to Argentina. That's the law. You have to return bones and things back to the countries where you found them. And we asked reporter Carolyn Beeler to find out what all that packing entails.
LaCarrera's usually tidy lab looks like Christmas morning as his students work around the clock to pack up Dreadnoughtus bones and ship them to southern Argentina.
We're going to move the front to here, and then we're going to turn it 90 degrees.
Based on my observations, there are two essential elements for packing the bones of one of the world's biggest dinosaurs: careful strategizing and grunting. Five students slowly lower a couple hundred-pound, 3-foot-wide vertebrae off a work table and into a wooden crate on the ground below. After the bone is in place, they slip plastic grocery bags filled with packing peanuts underneath and around the edges for padding. The bones will be shipped in 100 boxes and 50 wooden crates LaCarrera made himself in the lab.
Well, you can't just, you know, go to Home Depot and buy a dinosaur crate.
The crates will set sail for Buenos Aires from the port of Philadelphia next Friday. Lacovera, who's been working on Dreadnoughtus for nearly 11 years, says he'll raise a glass to the ship as it sails by.
This dinosaur is kind of like my buddy. You know, I've spent an awful lot of time with Dreadnoughtus in the desert, in the laboratory. There was a time when I was sick in the quarry down in Argentina, had a fever, and I remember just curling up around one of the bones with a blanket on me. So I've had quite a relationship with this animal. I'll definitely be sad to see Dreadnoughtus go.
A whole generation of students like Asia Carter, who grew up with Dreadnoughtus from high school through the beginning of her PhD, will be sad too.
There's a bone in there that I worked on that was kind of like my first big project as a preparator. It was my first, you know, chance to prove myself. And it's packed away now. I don't have any words. It's weird saying goodbye to something that's been in your life for so long.
Dreadnoughtus' remains will be housed in a tiny provincial museum in the Santa Cruz province of southern Argentina. Both the National Museum there and the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia hope to display 3D-printed versions of the skeleton. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson. Our associate producer, Megan Pinto, is the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Hey, if you missed some of the show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.